Last weekend, the president of the United States launched an attack on Iran, and everyone's been sort of paying attention to national security ever since. And, you know, you and I have been around through some tough presidential battles, particularly back when Bush was launching wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we've got some history here, right?
We do. And, you know, is this war going to actually impact the quest for the nominations in a couple of years? I mean, I think it's yet to be seen. We got to see how this goes. Are we out of this quickly, or is this going to drag on for a while? So I think maybe what we need to do is we need to kind of go back and look at some context, some historical context from the last couple of decades. You and I are both very young men in our early 50s. So, you know, the first kind of 20 years of our lives were dominated by the Cold War and Soviet aggression and pushing back against that. You know, I mean, I have very, very hazy memories of like Vietnam. So I was probably like four. Yeah. But you know, every night on the nightly news, there was talk about kind of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. You know, the threat of nuclear war sort of hung over everything, and you know that could happen here in the United States. Yeah. We had the movie Red Dawn, if you'll remember, in the mid '80s of like a full scale Soviet invasion of the United States,
repelled by teenagers. Remember that?
Absolutely. It was some great teenagers.
By teenagers.
Oh, it was amazing. Amazing.
Yes.
And so like all of the candidates during that period, you know, going all the way back to World War II, all have military experience, right? Mm-hmm. Carter was in the Navy. Reagan was in the Army. I mean, he was just making movies in San Francisco in the Army, but he was still in the Army.
He got a ribbon.
Dukakis was in the Army. Mondale was in the Army. George H.W. Bush obviously was, you know, a decorated naval aviator. And that was, you know, that was what military and national security was always the focus of a presidential election for most of our lives. And then kind of 88 to 92, you have, you know, the Soviet Union falling apart, the Berlin Wall coming down, and, you know, this existential threat that every American leader had to deal with was sort of like reduced. And, you know, then you see Bill Clinton get elected, who is the first president elected since Roosevelt that did not have military experience.
Yeah.
And that really changed things.
Yeah. Franklin Roosevelt, to be specific, because obviously Teddy was a veteran.
He obviously did. He was big in the military stuff.
Yes.
So.
Yes. The Rough Rider himself. You're right. So Bill Clinton, you know, the one thing that happened in that chronology, two things. George H.W. Bush gets elected. The Berlin Wall falls. The end of the Cold War is upon us. And then we go to war in Iraq. Remember, there's that first Iraq War, Operation Freedom, whatever, the one in Kuwait, the liberation
Desert Shield,
of Kuwait.
Desert Shield.
In Kuwait. And so everyone thought that George Bush was his war hero. He was undefeatable, like going into that 92 election, because his poll numbers in like a year or so out were in the 70s or something. I mean, he was the most popular president we'd seen in a long time. And then Bill Clinton sort of chiseled away at it. The economy was doing badly. And it's amazing. There's a funny thing, because it happened to Churchill too after World War II. People sort of said, great, thank you very much for your service. You did a fantastic job. But we've got some concerns to deal with right now, and maybe we don't think you're the right guy to handle these concerns right now. And you elect Bill Clinton.
Yeah, they turn domestic.
Absolutely, they turn domestic. And yeah, you elect Bill Clinton to the White House, which kind of changes. And now we've seen since him, what, Clinton was in the military, Barack Obama wasn't in the military, Donald Trump wasn't in the military. Joe Biden in the military. George Bush was barely in the military. He was hanging out in at an Air National Guard base, chasing ladies.
I think that's right. It's like in sort of the 90s and the 2000 election, it's not the most important issue in these presidential elections. And then, of course, 9/11 happens in 2001.
Yep.
And so then it became a very big issue in the 2004 race, and especially the 2004 race for the Democratic nomination. You know, you have John Kerry coming through that primary to win, extremely well known for being a decorated military veteran, Purple Heart winner, you know, and up against Howard Dean with no military experience, John Edwards, no military experience. Dick Gephardt had a little bit, but for the most part, was the war hero.
Don't forget about my boss.
Oh, yeah, well, Wesley Clark. Yes, Wesley Clark got into that race sort of late.
So what we
sorry to have forgotten him.
I know. Listen, buddy, don't forget about the Wes was the best.
I will not. I apologize.
But, you know, one of the things that happened in that race, we saw the dynamic. You lived it. We both lived it in different campaigns. Remember, John Kerry did very well. He was sort of the presumed Democratic nominee in that cycle going into it. He had all the big heavyweights. Everybody sort of chipped away at him. Howard Dean picked up. And then we saw Kerry kind of fall back a bit. And that's when Wes Clark got in that race at the end of 2003 to get in to sort of capture the national security mantle that a lot of people were worried and thought Democrats needed to have. Clark had kind of a boomlet, did pretty well toward the end of the year. But Kerry came back. And I'll say what we saw inside the Clark campaign is – every day John Kerry went up in the polls, Clark went down in the polls. It was like a one-for-one trade. And so by the time you get to January and the Iowa caucus, which Clark did not compete in, he also didn't compete in the Iowa caucus, which we look back on as a mistake. John Kerry won the Iowa caucus, and that was basically the end of the 2004 presidential campaign. He stormed through the rest of the primaries.
Yeah, we were very deliberate about focusing on his military experience and, you know, that he was the right guy for this job and for this time, and to really be able to juxtapose him against George Bush, who, you know, did not have, like, while he has quote unquote a military experience, it was not like a significant military experience, really looked like he had dodged the draft, used his kind of connections and his family to get out of serving, you know, and where John Kerry volunteered to go. And so we very much drew that distinction, and I think it really helped us.
Well, remember that
go from because
remember that convention. That convention, we had the phalanx of generals and admirals, like all the flag officers who were on that stage with John Kerry, saying he was the right choice for national security.
For sure. And what was the refrain of that speech? Send me. So because he said, you know, in Vietnam, I said, send me. And now I'm going to say, send me to the White House to be able to deal with these national security threats that we are dealing with.
So 4 years later, after that, you have Barack Obama, who is mostly famous, obviously, for the speech he gave at that 2004 convention, where he kind of talked about knitting together red states and blue states. And people thought, wow, this is like a great positive vision of America we could all rally around. And from this, you know, black guy from, you know, Chicago, it's like, you know, this is a great patriotic moment. But his most famous political moment in his life that got him, helped get him elected to the Senate, was he gave a speech about being against dumb wars in a primary for the U.S. Senate in Illinois in 2004. Being against, well, he actually did it before 2004, but anyway, being against dumb wars. And so you had the anti-war part of the Democratic Party rally around Barack Obama in that campaign, particularly in Iowa, as somebody who would be against dumb wars. Now, the thing about Obama, he would say this later. He said he was against dumb wars, didn't say he was against all wars. So later, people got to be upset with him because he did prosecute the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, didn't end it. He did send drones, and people were upset about that. But in his argument, he still had to protect America's national security.
Yeah, and that's always going to be the president's number one job is national security. So he had to deal with the reality of that. You know, and I do think it's also interesting in that race, you know, you had Hillary Clinton, who also did not have military experience, but you'll remember she ran that ad against him that was sort of the 3 a.m. ad. Like, it's 3 a.m. and the phone rings in the White House. Who do you want to answer that call? Me, with all of the experience that I have and, you know, of all the, you know, that I'm the one that you want doing that. I've been a senator, you know, I've been the first lady, et cetera. Or do you want this new guy who's only been a senator for, you know, a little over 2 years? And so that was I think at that point, it was a very effective ad. It didn't win the day overall, but it was pretty effective.
You know, the key that he was sort of, the argument that he made against Hillary Clinton, which I think was effective in that moment, was it was like judgment. Like, we have a change in judgment or a change in management. I mean, that was kind of the fundamental subtext, right? Like, I have the judgment to make good decisions, even though I don't have necessarily all the experience she has. But where has that experience gotten us, right? That experience has gotten us into these wars, into all this mess, into this debt. I've got better judgment. Electing her, she may be fine, but that would just sort of be a change in management. And I think he won the day. It was a contested day, but he won the day in that primary. in 2008. So that was the last sort of Democratic fight in 08 until 2016. And we kind of saw the what might regard as the Dean forces realign around Bernie Sanders with even more ferocity against Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah, and that, you know, I feel like that was much more about economic issues and sort of the economic position of the Democratic Party and what we'd seen Obama do, being very cozy with corporate interests, nobody getting prosecuted after the 2008 banking crisis. And I think that gave that a lot of momentum. You know, 2011, you know,
but Dean also was anti-war. Like, remember, Dean was an anti, I'm sorry,
right, okay,
Bernie was so also an anti-war candidate.
Absolutely. But let's go back one step. And you know, 2011, like, we get bin Laden. I mean, I do think that the national security threats are really waning. Like, we are not feeling threatened here in this country. And I think that's where we get to today. What are we going to feel? And that's how this war plays out. Like, are there going to be attacks on American soil? And then it'll be the number one issue in this. But if it doesn't, and if it sort of wanes here pretty quickly, what we have to remember is there are going to be people voting in 2028 who will be in their early 30s who do not remember 9/11.
Yeah.
They just don't remember.
But you know what they do remember? They do remember being at war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I am sure they do remember being at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what I would say is the average American person was not impacted particularly much by either the war in Iraq or Afghanistan.
But I think
if you had family that went, but the vast majority of people were not impacted personally by those wars.
So I think it was a political argument, a political concern. I think by a lot of people in 2020, even, and in, I mean, you know, Donald Trump was an anti-war candidate when he ran in 2016, and so he was talking about staying out of the Middle East, because I think there were people who felt like it wasn't a security threat argument; it was more like it's a dumb way for us to be spending all this money, right? When we've got all these real problems here at home, why don't we stop fighting these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, bring our troops home, and then also bring that money home and deal with the real problems that Americans are having? That, I think, was the argument that the wars centered around. And so you think of these people,
for sure,
who they spent their entire childhoods. We had troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. So that was a really big
deal. Very true. That's a good point. That is a good point.
So here we are again.
So here we are, and I think we'll see where it goes.
I mean, I think the question on the table right now is will there be a national security primary? Right now, that Trump is really putting, whether it's going into Venezuela, going into Iran, we don't know what else he has on the table. We think Cuba might be, you know, on the platter, you know, for later at this dinner. And so we got to figure out, I think the question is, will there be a national security primary among the Democrats where somebody has to show either judgment or forward thinking or some sort of credibility record on these questions to go into the general election?
I think that's right. It might be slightly broader than just national security, though. I feel like one of the keys for whoever the Democratic nominee is, and if they're going to be the eventual victor, is it is going to have to be someone who can put all of the foreign policy mess that Donald Trump has created back together. I mean, for decades, the United States has been the stable kind of bedrock of kind of the Western alliance. You know, I mean, the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. Like, it was our ability to support NATO, to support the EU, and kind of everything. Like, that was, people could count on us, could count on the United States. And that is simply not true anymore. And somebody's got to come back and put that together and also be able to have a vision for how do we change the American electoral system here to sort of make it a less of a chance that we just get Trump 3 kind of in 4 years after, even if we win in 2028. In 2032, how do we keep Don Jr. out of there? And we're right back to this sort of kind of these know-nothing politics that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, I think that may be right in building an enduring coalition. And, you know, we'll talk about this later, but how do we empower Republicans? What happens in the Republican Party that they can hold back these MAGA forces? Or maybe we just do have some coalition that's kind of like this alliance of constitutional interests that don't really share a lot of political a lot of political interest in terms of all the domestic policy questions. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But we need to get back to sort of politics stopping at the border's edge or the water's edge. And, you know, I mean, just like the thought that we would not be absolutely all in supporting Ukraine against the right. Russians, like, it, I mean, that is
against the Russians,
the 80s or 90s against the Russians. It's like unfathomable. And, you know, it's just like, it would be, I mean, those votes would have been 99-1 and the one would in the Senate and the one would be somebody who's like, well, there shouldn't be any war at all. But it would certainly wouldn't be pro-war. Wouldn't be pro-Russia.
Right.
It's just, we're just in crazy times.
We're in crazy times. And you can make the argument that we're, one, not defending Ukraine enough against Russia. Two, because people view America's foreign policy right now to be so erratic and frankly so heavy-handed, there are people who are nervous about America and how we're acting on the global stage.
Yeah.
And it's driving them into the hands of the Chinese, because I've heard people say, and I've read people who say, at least China looks more stable. You can predict what they're mm-hmm. going to do. You can't predict what Donald Trump is going to do. And that is unnerving people who either are our allies or they're quote-unquote neutral, but they were leaning toward kind of an American global leadership model.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly right. And we've seen it with Europe, we've seen it with the UK, we've seen it with Canada. I mean, this is we are doing kind of really bad damage to the United States' standing in the world at this point.
So in Iran, you looked up, we were going back and forth about this, how people are handling this question of Iran. And I was at a conference this weekend with a bunch of Democrats, and this question about national security came up. And one of the, obviously people were very into the poll that came out. Only 1 in 4 Americans seem to support this decision. Obviously, yeah. There's also some concern about what this decision will look like later. And the question for me is Democrats have been making a process argument. A lot of Democrats have been talking about whether or not to go to Congress, if that's the question. Is that really the question? Or is there another question about whether or not we should be doing it at all? Should we even be in Iran? And I think there's a real debate, or it's not a debate. It's not an open debate, but there are two sort of, I think, political approaches right now. One is a process one and one is a kind of end result one about how we handle this Iran moment. And it's new, so it may change.
It may change, but I feel like Democrats do this a lot, right? Like, we get focused on the process as opposed to the, like, we really shouldn't be attacking Iran. Like, yes, we can all agree that that regime was oppressive and that, like, that's bad and people should have democracy. Like, that's fine. Like, but we always kind of say that and they're like, well, but, you know, Congress should have voted for it. I just, like, no, we shouldn't be attacking Iran. We just shouldn't. It's not good. It doesn't make us safer. It doesn't make Israel safer. Like, it's just, it's bad policy all around. And 75% of Americans agree with that. So just, like, go, no, we shouldn't be doing this. Stop. Don't do this. Like, just couching the words. Like, so I think I saw a couple of quotes where at least 2 or 3 of the candidates say, I'm against regime change wars. Now, that sounds like something that has been tested, or it's from some messaging shop that, like, that is, like, sort of acceptable to people. Like, oh, people really want to hear regime. No regime change wars. Just be against dumb wars like this. Right. It's so easy. So anyway, and this seems to strike me as maybe it's not a dumb war, but it's definitely an unnecessary war at this time.
So there are a couple of quotes, I think, that illuminate the kind of the process argument. I mean, Gavin Newsom said Donald Trump is once again sidestepping the Constitution. No justification, no authorization from Congress, no clear objective. Josh Shapiro, in our democracy, the American people, through our elected representatives, decide when our nation goes to war, Trump acting unilaterally without congressional approval. He also talked about Iran repressing its people, but that how that doesn't justify. It's interesting. The one person who got it right here, and I think we ought to give her the credit for it, I think, or at least leaned into, was Kamala Harris. And she said, Donald Trump is dragging the United States into a war the American people don't want. I am opposed to a regime change in Iran, and our troops are being put in harm's way for the sake of Trump's war of choice. This is a dangerous and unnecessary gamble, not the way to dismantle this threat. I mean, so I think, like, that was kind of a forward leaning.
Yeah, that's
this
pretty,
is wrong.
That's pretty direct.
And here's why. Yep. I mean, look, she was the vice president. She did sit in the Situation Room where these questions came up. So,
yeah,
you know, she had the most recent, I think, experience here on this.
Yeah. And I think also Shapiro says something like, well, you know, he hasn't really fully explained why we're doing this. And like, you know, I mean, does he have some secret reason that we're, that we don't know about? And
right.
would we trust Trump even if he gave us a secret reason that he was doing this, if he explained it more? I mean, this is, it was like loud and vocally opposed, I think is where is the way to go on this. So.
Yeah. Why do it? Why now? Right. I mean, if we want to talk about the Republicans, yeah. Marco Rubio has got some like cockamamie thing about, you know, well, the Israelis were going to attack. And if the Israelis attacked them, Iran, then Iran's going to attack us. So then we had to attack Iran first in order to, in order to do it. You know, so, okay, it seems a little bit circuitous. Maybe the argument should have been with Netanyahu first to get him to not do it, you know, like yeah. instead of joining in this big effort. So I think, you can make an argument, and I think we have a lot of people in the streets of America and streets of the world who are happy that the Ayatollah is gone. And that's a very yeah. fair argument. You can make an argument, bad person, bad regime, repressive to a lot of people, people died. It's good that the Ayatollah is gone. But we don't know, though, is what's coming next. We don't know whether or not right. there's, you know, what reprisals will come next. We don't know who is going to be in that government next. I mean, we just don't know anything. And who has confidence that the Trump administration has done like a 7-step plan to figure out, you know, how all this is going to go. And frankly, for my money, we don't talk enough about the threat to the homeland. Like Cash yeah. Patel and Tulsi Gabbard being in charge and Kristi Noem being in charge of Homeland Defense does not give me a lot of comfort that we're all going to be safe in the mall.
Right. And the 22-year-old running counterterrorism. I mean, we're not in a good spot. I mean, this is the issue with hiring people who are just really not quite kind of fit to purpose for these jobs.
Yeah. I mean, I think the national security establishment or leadership is very concerning. And the general incompetence of the Trump administration is also concerning. I mean, Pete Hegseth was texting reporters the first time they were going to war and taking, you know, like victory laps on Signal chats. Like, what is going on here? And we're supposed to have confidence in these people to keep us safe. And like you said, the president talked to us about it. We went for 2 days this weekend without the president saying anything other than that 2 a.m. statement he made in the hat. Yeah. In the morning from Mar-a-Lago, that was the convincing that they were going to do on this?
Yeah, and now he's come with, well, a couple folks died. It happens. It's going to happen some more. That's what happens. Like, really? I mean, like, it didn't have to happen. Did not have to happen. Yeah. I think for the Democratic candidates, at least, the ones who are incredibly vocal and in Trump's face are going to really be able to make some mileage with this. So that's like a Gavin Newsom. J.B. Pritzker's been pretty vocal against him. So those people are going to be kind of that's going to help them because they've got the platform to really take on this administration, point out the incompetence, point out when they're making mistakes or doing dumb stuff. And so that's really going to help them. I will note what we noticed was no comment from Gretchen Whitmer, no statement from Gretchen Whitmer that I could find regarding this so far. You know, and even when we attacked the nuclear facilities back in June, she's like, well, I'm worried about keeping people in Michigan safe. So it's another indication that maybe she is not making this race. So, which I think is what we predicted last week.
Yeah. And one candidate did take kind of a more pure peace position. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think we have to talk about her. I mean, she called the strikes unlawful and that's unnecessary, and that Trump, yep. instead of negotiations, he chose war instead. And she warned that violence begets violence, which is a little bit more of a pure peace position. It's not, you know, I yep. think she recognizes that, you know, the Ayatollah was a bad person, but she does come from the generation that was raised in the midst of, you know, these Iraq and Afghanistan wars and bunch all of, the yeah. money that was spent prosecuting that and not helping people get educations and, you know, healthcare and, you know, economic benefits
right.
that people need.
Yeah. And I think we've got Iraq to a little bit of a stable place, but Afghanistan, not so much. So, you know, it's,
well, somebody said to me
all that time.
Somebody said to me this weekend, if you think about Afghanistan this way, it was Taliban, 20 years of war, death, and treasure, Taliban. Right?
Yeah.
Like that was sort of the Afghanistan story of the last 25, 26 years was, you know, we dismantled the Taliban. We spent a lot of blood and treasure in that country. And then the Taliban came back. And now we are basically yeah. back to where we were maybe without Al Qaeda, which is important, not an insignificant thing. But
yeah,
you know, Afghanistan's back to where it was before.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
So, do you think it's going to matter? Do you think it's going to matter in 2028?
I think the foreign policy and putting foreign policy back together and reestablishing America's place on the world stage, that is absolutely going to matter. And so whoever the candidate is that's going to come through this is going to have to show some ability at foreign policy. They're going to be able to have to deal with other world leaders, and they're going to have to be able to reestablish the credibility of the United States. And that is going to be a very, very hard job. So that definitely will matter. And I think the national security side of things will have to see if that specific issue is what's gonna be part of that.
You know, one thing the Democrats have to be careful about, to me, is not letting Trump paint Democrats in the corner of being one, either unpatriotic, or two, being soft, and soft on bad guys, right? And this is the thing: he goes after quote unquote bad guys. Maduro's a bad guy. Ayatollah in Iran's a bad guy. Yep. Khamenei, and then you're question whether or not, you know, you're also against bad guys. He did this in the State of the Union. Remember, he asked that question, stand up if you believe America should be protecting Americans or on the side of illegals, and all the Republicans stood up and all the Democrats didn't. I got to tell you, I thought that was a bad moment for the Democrats.
Yeah, it's not a great visual.
Yeah, in that hall, because, you know, you should be for Americans. And then you can make the argument later why being, you know, I think the way to keep Americans safe is to have a country people want to come to, not one that sends people away. I think, you know, keeping America safe means living up to our values, how we treat people when they're in detention matters. You can do all the rest of the caveats, but sometimes those images really do matter. And he's running ads about that. So I imagine they're going to do that to all these folks on national security and going into the 26th election, painting Democrats as being watery for trying to protect Americans. And so, you know, we live through this. Sometimes you got to stand up and be tougher in public in a more bald way, and then you can do your nuance. But the toughness and the strength is a better word. The strength is the place to lead on.
Yeah, I think that's right. But then let's go back. If we're going to go back to history again, let's go back to 2002, 2003, and you've got all of these Democrats, including John Kerry, voting for military action in Iraq and giving the president the authorization for that. And then, you know, it doesn't go great. And then John Kerry spending 2 years sort of going back on that vote and trying to like go sideways, where I think down deep in his heart, he did not want to authorize that vote, but was worried like, oh, they're going to paint you as soft on terrorists and, you know, that you're, you know, for this. And like, it's like overthinking it. Like, you know, stand with your values and stand strongly in your values, you know, because if he didn't have to go back, remember, I voted for it before I voted against it. I mean, that like, that was really, really tough for him to come back from a messaging perspective. So I get that we want to be for America. We want to be tough, but we want to be for America in the right way. And you've got to stay true to your values. And this supporting this war is not going to be where we are. So
no, I don't think it's going to wear well, but I also remember another person I worked for, Senator Bob Graham, who was co-chair of the Intelligence Committee. And Bob Graham's point, when he voted against the war and the war in Iraq, and he said, I'm voting against this war not because I'm afraid of terrorists. I'm voting against this war because we're not going after terrorists.
Right.
Like, he was making the argument like, I'm pro fighting terrorism. I just think there aren't terrorists in Iraq. Right? Like, there's no evidence that Iraq is where they were like fomenting terrorism. So, you know, I would say like find a place to be strong, where you want to protect America, you want to do something that's going to be tough, but it's not the thing that the president wants to do or the Republicans, because they're making these decisions for things in ways that we just can't really understand. Like, there's something about this that we don't know, and we're going to find out, but there's a reason why we did this that they're not telling us. They're not telling us everything. That's the truth.
Right.
They're just not telling us everything about this war in Iran, and we've got to find out what's missing, why we went there now.
Yeah, I agree completely.
All right. Well, that's another week here at Trailblaze. We'll see you next week, where we'll talk about some more 2028. We're the first place talking about 2028 as our main focus, and we're happy to do it.
Yeah, 2 years to go. 2 years to go to the primary start.
See you then. Bye, Matt.